Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tiagi Delanerol, executive director of the Employee Wellbeing Council and founder of OOT Social Health, stepping in to host this special episode. Usually the podcast is hosted by Adjoa K. Boahidi, but today I have the privilege of interviewing her. So let's just highlight some of Adjoa's impressive career, shall we? So 20 years in talent management with 15 years focused on equity, diversity and inclusion. She's the co-founder of NGen People Performance Inc., a leading generational diversity consulting for Fortune 500 companies, 5 years in the nonprofit public sector, working with equity-denied groups, founder of now AKB Talent Edge, specializing in transforming talent management systems using soft systems methodology for equity, and she's a proud mother of her eight-year-old daughter who inspires her every single day. Join us in really understanding Adjoa's journey, insights, and her passion for creating well-being and inclusion in the workplace. Welcome, Adjoa.
Hi, Tiagi. It's nerve-wracking to be on the other end. I'll start with that.
Yeah, no, I know. And now the tables are turned. So there you go. So Adjoa, before we explore the state of DEI and the link it holds between well-being and well-doing in the age of AI, we want to start by getting to know you a little bit better as a person. So our focus in the council, as you know, is really centered around the human-centric approach. So you're human, so let's center around you. I want to ask you a couple questions from the Preuss questionnaire, and we'll end with a couple more questions towards the end of the podcast. So the French essayist and author Marcel Proust used these questions in parlor games, as he believed the answer to these questions really helped reveal an individual's true nature. So we're going to start with, which talent would you most like to have?
So it's funny, Tiagi, when I decided to include the Proust questionnaire in the podcast, I again didn't ever think that I would have to answer the questions. So I was trying to think of really clever things. And some of our guests in the past have said clever things. Mine is pretty basic in the sense I'd love to learn or know how to sing. So I'm a horrendous singer. I had a boyfriend in my early 20s who I stopped singing because people had given me feedback I couldn't sing. And so I was humming in the car one time on a road trip. And he said to me, "What did you do with the money?" And I said, "What money?" He said, "The money your family gave you for humming lessons." So that was the end. That was the end of my musical career. And I cannot sing. My daughter is very sweet. When I sing to her every night, I sing her a little song, Skidamarinky Dink. She tells me I have a lovely voice. I know she's being kind and she wants chocolate. So if I could sing, I think that would fill my heart because there's endorphin release and it's such an amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be nice, you know, to learn how to sing, like, you know, have like Beyonce's voice, right? Like, wow, what a talent.
I'd even take like four levels below that.
That works seriously.
Four levels below that.
I know. Okay. All right. So another question, just to get to know you a little bit better, is if you were to die and were to come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
So I thought again about this, and I was going to say an Olympian, but I want to take it back even further. I want to go to a decathlete in the Olympics. Because if you think about that, what an amazing ability to compete in 10 different sports. And potentially medal or be right in the elite in 10 different sports. So I have a tremendous respect for athletes, and professional athletes, but athletes in general, marathoners. I'm one of those silly people when I see marathoners run, I cry. I have such deep respect for that level of commitment and discipline, to which I have sometimes to a degree, whether it's in an athletics or professional life. But I just really admire those who reach those elite levels.
So could we possibly see you in the future in a marathon?
No. My furthest distance was 10K. I am not, I would like to suggest I'm not built for marathons. And it's just, I mean, your long runs are 6 hours when you're trained out. And I honestly, there's lots of stuff I can do in 6 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus your 8-year-old keeps you busy, right?
You're about to. That, sometimes she could drive me to run a marathon.
Perhaps. Okay, so let's kind of get right into, you know, some of the meat and potatoes of the question, right?
Sure.
To start, let's set the context. So how are we doing DEI today in the space?
So I would give it a mixed review. When you go back historically, let me do the history of the answer. When we go back, let's say even 20 years ago, when my co-founder, business partner, Giselle Kavari, and I started Engine in 2003, we wanted to focus on generational diversity, which was not spoken about at the time. We specifically actually never in Canada and in the U.S., though in the U.S. it was a bit more acceptable, we actually never used the term diversity. We linked the work we were doing to performance and engagement, which it is. All DEI, we'll talk about that more, links to well-being, engagement, and performance. But we didn't actually use the diversity word, so to speak, because it wasn't going to resonate with business leaders 20 years ago.
Okay.
Now, the good news is, fast forward, I'm not going to go through every year by year, but yeah. Fast forward, right, to 2020, with the murder of George Floyd, there was just this tsunami of desire for change and a recognition. First, I guess we would start with the recognition and then a desire for change. And some organizations had already been on their journey, right? I mean, in the last 20 years, some organizations are committed to DEI work and would have teams or would have dedicated people. But 2020 really shifted that tide and it became the focus and sometimes the central focus for many organizations for a couple of years. And McLean and Company did a PR firm did a report in 2024, and DEI focus had shifted down to number 7 in the list of priorities. So we again see a bit of an adjustment. But certainly that was a really good thing after 2020, right? Was this increased focus on DEI. Part of the mixed review, though, is that we didn't understand that some organizations didn't understand what it actually means to embark on this journey, to maintain it, and to actually transform or have transformative change. So we you know, and I talk with Sophia Drolla about this in a podcast that'll come up next year, is this sort of desire for KPIs or quarter, in our quarter by quarter business world, we've also transitioned that into the work, let's say, in DEI. And so the expectation is that we will make changes in a somewhat quick order. And then when that hasn't happened in the last 3-4 years, because it is a longer journey, it's a journey, it's not a destination as such, we have, right, some leaders have become frustrated by it. And the last piece, I mean, of course, I could just speak 20 minutes on this question. The last piece that I want to just highlight is that we've oftentimes also focused on changing people, not necessarily our systems. And so, right, we provide a lot of unconscious bias training, allyship training, and these are important factors, yeah. But they're in and of themselves, that's not what is going to transform the practices in an organization. We also need to look at our talent management practices and figure out what do we need to do within them, map them, and then look at the behavior of these systems, and what do we need to do and change within them in order to drive greater change. So we're some organizations are further along on this journey than others, but I think we really need to now start focusing on the system rather than just on people.
So that really kind of ties in with the evolution of your career, right? So you started with, you know, generational kind of lens, right, where you were taking a look at that, and then now you're really looking at the systems and how it's impacting. Diversity in the workplace. So that's fantastic.
Thanks.
We can see the evolution.
So,
yeah. So is one of the challenges a question around the definition or execution? So what is the North Star for building equity?
So again, my master's degree was in philosophy, so I'm going to say a lot of depends and both and mixed reviews on two sides of the coin, right? So I think it is a bit of definition, and we have spent a lot of time in this sector, I think, thinking about, you know, what does it mean diversity, inclusion, and equity, and in particular as it relates to equity. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But I think it's also we still spend a lot of time almost building that business case when we talk about the business case for DEI.
Yep.
And to me, we need to move beyond that. I mean, we know that there's a gender pay gap. We know that there's racism, bigotry, homophobia. If we're still convincing people, then I would suggest those people that still need convincing also still believe that the earth is flat, right? So yeah. We need to move beyond that. Like, let's move away from the business case. The business case to me is quite clear. I say that, you know, boldly. And so now let's look at what we need to do in order to achieve that change. And we oftentimes talk about wanting to, you know, remove systemic barriers, but we don't talk about the process by which we're going to remove those systemic barriers. So I think it is a matter of definition as well as execution. And this next part that I'm going to talk about, it might be a bit controversial. I mean, it is the definition of what, you know, equity means, because I think a lot of organizations in their strive, they've worked on the diversity piece, the representation, they've worked on the inclusion piece, and they sometimes believe that those two things equate or lead into equity. And I think they're actually quite distinct. In addition, the most popular image for equity that's being used is the baseball diamond with people and individuals on different levels of crates.
Okay.
Looking over the fence. And it's used as a defining the difference between equality, where everybody has the same crate level, but right, the shorter person obviously can't look over the fence, versus equity, where the shorter person has a higher crate. And so while that definition is, I'm not suggesting it's inaccurate, I'm not sure that it is helpful in the context of equity execution. So how, if I'm an organizational leader, I'm in HR, I'm in DEI, I'm a leader, how do I know, Tiagi, how high your crate needs to be compared to my crate, right? And so, and how do I individualize that? I think that, and then I can go on to where I believe it's about justice, that image is about justice, and it, maybe it is our North Star. And so there's lots that we can do in the interim to achieve greater equity. Because okay. What I fear is, what happens is that when we use that image and we insist that we have to figure out how to do this trait thing,
yeah,
that it leads to something called oppression Olympics. And where different equity denied groups are competing with each other to prove that they need that higher crate. And so again, if I'm in an organization, I don't know how to manage that. I don't know how to respond to that. And I don't know how to create that environment. What I'm hoping for is that we get rid of the crates, we get rid of the fence, and we figure out a way for all of those individuals to sit in the stands.
From what I've discerned over the years, a lot of this really comes down to leadership. Do they see the value? And if they do, then they're going to ensure there's elements that are implemented throughout the organization to help with that level of justice you speak of. Can you share your thoughts around the link between well-being and DEI?
Of course. So, right, all organizations have diversity in them, you know, whether it's gender orientation, race, urban, rural, you name it. And so we have to recognize those differences. I mean, we have also moved away from a thinking that we just, you know, treat everybody the same, or we say, oh, I don't see color. Really? I do every day. So, right. And so, or it doesn't matter what race, creed, or somebody is, I in my hiring practices. Really? Okay. Mm. So we have to recognize those differences and then recognize that if I can't be me, I can't be well. Right. In order for me to. And so if I'm well, we know that the well-being links to well-doing. So we really want to focus on that, on creating that wellness, creating that space. And it is just inherently linked in a diverse population. If people can't be the, you know, authentic self, whether that is from a personality characteristic or a background characteristic, then they are not well, and they're not going to expend that discretionary effort. And fundamentally, I mean, again, I guess I am making a bit of a business case. Fundamentally, we know that discretionary effort in this day and age, where people have side gigs and side hustles and families and so on, we as organizations want people to spend more discretionary effort with us. And so the way we're going to achieve that by ensuring greater well-being, it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. And as you recollect in the broadcast also with Rodney Mano, right, he really highlighted the need for that psychological safety, which is also tied to, right, my various identities, my various diversity and psychological safety, and the connection between psychological safety and well-being. So really, we want to be in that center of understanding all the components of well-being, which is, right, the goal of a bit of a plug for our council. All of the components have a through line of DEI, and then relate that to well-being, knowing that it ignites well-doing. And in an upcoming podcast, we talk also with Don Carter as to how community involvement is so critical to well-being. Why? And community involvement has a DEI angle. I might be interested not only in my local community, but maybe my also country of origin, that community. And so how do organizations ensure that that is a part of the mix?
I love that. And I really, you know, the one thing that I'm really going to take away from today's conversation is around that piece around discretionary effort. To be honest, it's not a term that I've heard a lot being used, but I love how you phrase that. And clearly, you know, it's so evident with your like psychology kind of like philosophical background, how you've gone through and really thought through what it means to be human and bring that authentic self right into the workplace. I love how you phrase that. Okay, so you and I have had a few discussions about your fears as it relates to DEI and artificial intelligence. Why don't you share what they are with the audience?
So, you know, in thinking about this, and honestly, it's been a journey a bit for me. So when you and I first met, we've had conversations. And then in the podcast with Mike Tweedy, right, I raised the concern, and I'm not much of a science fiction fan, but I remember this so well, right? The Space Odyssey 2001, Hal saying, "I can't do that for you, Zane." And that is my image of where we're heading, right? Like, Hal's not going to open the door. But yeah. I have to say, I'm really coming along. We had a conversation also with Mark Grimwood as to how recruiting can be aided by AI. We've had conversation with Neil Hunter as how AI can democratize learning and individualize learning plans. So I will say now that, again, I'm going to be a bit mixed, because I think we still have to listen to somebody like Geoffrey Hinton, right? The father of AI. I mean, he's won a Nobel Prize, and he still is cautioning us into the use of AI and the role it plays. So I'm going to say I'm a bit, again, mixed. I'm cautiously optimistic, but in particular, because my focus is about DEI, I don't want us to lose the gains that we've made and still need to make. And so maybe I can give you a couple examples where, you know, fears still remain. So applicant tracking systems, about 6 months ago, I wrote an article about applicant tracking systems being the death knell to equity. And so when we know that these systems, unless they are programmed right, the algorithms are right, the training data is correct and diverse, the data in and of itself is diverse, there's a potential to output the same people over and over again that get ranked. And so if we don't have a person on the other end who's able to question that data, that ranking, and say, why are the top 20% all from our competitors, we've all done the same role, and really all we're doing is cycling through the same people over and over again, we are not going to expand our pool. And we're actually not going to get innovation that we constantly say we want in our teams, because you're not going to have diversity of perspective. There's also performance management software out there right now. There's an onboarding, and there's probably more than one, but the one that I saw, and I won't name, is about the first 90 days giving managers a ranking as to how somebody is performing. I think that could be potentially, again, a helpful mechanism by which to identify factors. And certainly if you go on the website, that's what they indicate. I think there's also a danger there, because some managers will rely on that, right, and say you're on the bottom 20 or you're on the top 20. What about learning styles? What about, right, people learn differently, people onboard differently.
So there's also potential to for that to not be a good tool. So I'm still a believer that AI is a tool that needs to be questioned.
Yes.
So that's where my reservation still remains, though I'm no longer, I will say, I'm no longer doom and gloom like Pat was even 6 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I've also had time to reflect, right, in through our conversations and definitely through a lot of the podcast guests. They've also helped really kind of enlighten me in many respects. And the one big thing is I think we'll have a very bright future as long as we put the right guardrails now in place so that we can, you know, kind of work in a symbiotic way, right? The beautiful thing, actually, I think about AI is we may actually as a species become more human because of AI, right? We may actually flourish in our human capabilities through connecting more, through speaking more with each other and kind of coming up with new innovations because of that ability to now have the time and the space to connect as opposed to just working on mundane tasks that truly can be taken over by AI and machines, right? Anyways, moving on. Within that same vein, right, how do we mitigate the risks? Like you spoke briefly to it, but can you kind of dive in a little bit further around what do you think we need to do in order to mitigate the risks associated with AI?
And there's a lot of literature out there, right, as to the risk mitigation, whether it's by law firms or tech firms, as well as training programs on that. And I think it does come to data. I mean, right, once upon a time, we used to say about, you know, computer mainframes, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
And so we have to also remember that the data that's out there that's being mined or used for training may inherently have bias within it. So if we're not careful about the data that we're using, we may then the output may be right biased.
Yeah.
So I think that and certainly I'm no expert on this, but in you see that theme repeatedly mm-hmm. across everyone. There's also organizations like the Vector Institute and so on, where, you know, the establishment of committees, ethics committees, really being thoughtful and intentional about how these tools are going to be used in an organization is a way to mitigate and is critical. Mm-hmm. But as individuals, and maybe that's also my, you know, one of my tips is being really conscious and using your critical thinking skills on the output, on what is coming out of anything that you're using, any kind of
analyzing the output.
That's it. Analyzing the output. You know, I sort of use sometimes the Prime Directive, which I realize is not quite correct, about do no harm, really was about not interfering in cultures. But, you know, when we think about AI, we need to ensure that it does good. First of all, of course, do no harm. But we have to really think about how will this do better or do good? And then as Neil Hunter also refers to it, right? This is a tool. This is something that we need to use. And I used to use the word copilot before it was, you know, branded by a certain company. But really, it should be our guide on the side. It should not be the main stage. So I think there's a number of ways that we can mitigate how and when we're using it.
Yep. Yeah, I love your piece around just having that retrospective, like making sure that as we're using AI for outputs, right, we analyze the output and then use our critical thinking as humans to just validate, is this the right path we want to go down? And could those algorithms, right, providing they're open, so that's the other piece, right, opening up the algorithms, really understanding what the weights are, I think will help people understand how to tweak so that we can make it that much better as we evolve. Because nothing's perfect right out of the gate, right? But that's just, you got to keep working at it.
For sure. I think what I appreciate, though, that Jeffrey Hinton says, though, too, is that the speed by which this is happening, it's actually in some ways developing and happening quicker than we're able to catch up and put in those guardrails. So I think we have to, today, now, be already very critical. Not say, oh, you know, we have time. I don't think we actually do have. So whether you as an individual leader or as an organization really need to kind of get on it, get on it, right? Because we don't in some ways want to be in the same situation as we were with social media and other right sort of crazes where after the fact, after the barn door, and I'm terrible at idioms, but I think it's after the barn door is open or closed that something bad happens. Whatever that idiom is, we don't want to be there with AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone is very aware of like the potential for harm, right? And hopefully we have leaders within organizations and even government for that matter, really starting to implement those, I guess, those guidelines and those guardrails, and probably regulation, right? Around this piece as well. So, okay.
It's regulation. Sorry, I was going to say it's regulation and every organization really moving away from that awareness. And to your point, there's a lot of awareness out there. And even in academic journals, I read one that was terrifically boring about a systemic literature review of DEI and guidelines within AI. And there's a ton of awareness in a nutshell. They also said there's a ton of awareness out there, but there's not a lot of execution. And again, we come back to that term of execution and how to ensure, right, that we are we're not going to leave people behind, even if it's just from a technology perspective of access to these tools, right? We already still talk about access to computers in certain regions in our countries.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we just have to have folks like yourself that will share like ways in which executives need to approach this angle, because I think a lot of companies right now are just looking to implement various types of AI all throughout the organization. It's, you know, they're kind of rushing in this race for implementing AI, and we do need to have like folks like yourself who are leaders and consulting with executives to really help them think through as they're implementing. So that's great that you do.
That's kind of you, Tiagi. I thought you were going to, you're calling me a leader. I thought you were going to say, be like the Muppets. Remember the Muppets? There were the two old guys who sat in the balcony and went, meh, did that full court. No, did you pay attention to that? So I appreciate the kinder and gentler characterization of my.
Of course. And it's, you know, it's important. Because systems are extremely important for many, many companies, right? Like we put all of these systems in place for increasing efficiency, but we kind of need to kind of dive into, well, how could these systems be implemented in a more thoughtful manner so it has better outcomes for really and truly even the customers that many of these companies serve. Because if the employees are not coming up with the innovations and bringing their true authentic selves, then really the people that suffer, I think, are the customers in the end. So that's also something for us to think about. Okay, so we want to end this part of the conversation with very practical advice. So what is one thing I, as a leader today, can take away to build greater equity, in your opinion, Ajua?
So maybe I'll piggyback on what I just characterized myself as. Be the Muppet. Be the Muppet in the balcony, right? So question, I think, question what is being requested of you. Question even currently your talent management. So if you're a hiring manager, question the process. Question barriers that might be within that system. Recognize you're part of the system for sure. But ask your HR colleagues, why are we doing it this way? And who might we be excluding by doing it this way? When it comes to, you know, rolling out AI, I mean, maybe you are asking questions around the data or what are the potential risks here? So I think that the critical analytic piece, I would really encourage people and leaders in particular, individual contributors, to really question more. And that is something that sometimes we don't take the time to do. We don't pause and reflect. Take the time to pause and reflect. So I say mm-hmm. that's tip number one. Mm-hmm. And then tip number two is really question.
Yeah. Well, one thing being now, you know, being a part of a startup, right? What I value is the time that I spend with the development team around retrospectives. It's almost something that needs to be really brought into practice, right, throughout business, is having those retrospectives kind of throughout the implementation of various initiatives or systems review, is having those moments to pause and reflect and how can we make things better, right?
I'm going to turn the tables. I'm seizing back the mic, Tiagi, because I think that was a really good point. But I'm not sure that everybody understands what that means when you say retrospective in the process with your development team. So would you mind expanding on that?
Sure. I mean, right now, generally speaking, when in a development process of software specifically, we typically deploy a 2-week sprint cycle, right? So when you develop, when you put the sprint together, you normally have a set of tickets that you're looking to solve for, right? And you're working through the tickets. And each sprint, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get better and better and better. And so towards the right before the sprint gets finalized, you normally have some time to do a bit of retrospective with the development team to find out, okay, what's worked, what didn't work, why did certain bugs come up, how could we make things better? And it's really great because you can see over time the evolution of how the team kind of increases their velocity through the practice of retrospectives. Having an hour to kind of deep dive with the team and really understanding, okay, what's worked, what didn't work, how can we make things better, really helps us ultimately become faster and leaner and really the catch the gotchas. And it always it comes over time. It's an evolutionary process. So I hope that helps explain.
Super great tip. Amazing.
Okay, fantastic. So now we're towards the tail end of, you know, the podcast. It's been great. I really enjoyed learning more from you, Adjoa. And we're gonna end again with some of the Proust questions that we started off with. Not the same ones, a couple different ones. So the first of two that I'm going to end with is, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
Well, there's probably a few, but there's one that immediately springs to mind that anybody who knows me would probably agree with, and that is greater patience. I am not a patient person. I maybe come by it honestly through my parents, but in grade 5, I was assessed for a program in the school and, you know, talked about the strengths and the weaknesses of the student. And the weakness was she gets frustrated very easily when somebody doesn't seem to get it or move along quickly enough. It was 10.
Yeah, now Gabe is...
So I would suggest that I do try to work on it. Having a child, also, boy, oh boy, does that test that skill. So I do recognize that sometimes my, you know, brain is working super fast and or certainly I'm not always giving people the space and the time that is needed. And so it is, you know, in my best attempt, I would like to continue to work on that skill.
Well, I feel like you and I, we just clicked right away, right? On so many levels when we first started talking, and I feel like I'm with you. I agree that patience is definitely a virtue and something that a lot of folks can work on. But even, don't you feel also, because we're in this digital era too, that it's tested even more because we're intended to move fast.
We intended to move fast, and sometimes we move too fast when we should take a pause.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, very last question. Who are your heroes in real life?
Yeah, this is also a no-brainer for me. Like the patients one, it was my mom. So my mom was an amazing human being who, you know, raised with my father, with obviously her husband, my father, 3 children. Who, you know, are all very spirited and quite apart in age. So it must have been interesting to 5 years later go through the same phase again and say, why did we have them so far apart? But she, you know, she was a woman who was born in the 30s and always worked and always wanted to work. I was a boredom baby because we lived in Malta at the time for 4 years and she couldn't work in the late 60s, early 70s. And so She said I needed something to do, so we had you. I don't know if she ever regretted that decision, but it was too late anyway. And she just was very kind. And maybe I'll just close by saying, you know, I learned something that she told a neighbor friend who told me after she had passed, that my mother said to her, Lori, it is not what you have that is important. It is what you're able to give. And so that I know, right? I mean, I can now say without tearing up, but that is something I didn't realize that she had instilled in me by example, because I had never heard her use that phrase. And yet that is something she instilled in our family. And the notion of family and connection and friendship. I always say if I can be, you know, a third of what my mom was to my daughter and to my friends and family, then I'm doing okay.
Well, she sounds like an incredible lady. Be a role model to you in your life.
Absolutely.
You're lucky to have her. Thank you for sharing your insights, specifically around how DEI truly ties into well-being in the age of AI. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us on the Well-Being Ignites Well-Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.